Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and we're going to boss the other people. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about all the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might have missed this past week. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Pod Save the People. Here we go. Two-week extension around ICE is the top of the thing on my mind right now. Here we go. Another week. This is Duray at DRY on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson at Sun Pulpit on Instagram.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at Bossier Shay on Instagram, at Bossier S on Spill. Speaking of the two-week extension on ICE, let's talk about the Dems and what's happening in the Democratic Party. Lots of movement, lots of news this week, including Kamala Harris relaunching headquarters, has created a lot of buzz among the pundits and the online, let's call them literati. Really interested to hear what you all are seeing, hearing, thinking about Kamala seemingly wading back into the electoral waters.
Wait, are you calling the literati from the Harlem Renaissance? Is that like is that where you're getting that from?
I said the online literati, you know?
Oh, that's so, yes. You know me, I'm like, that's good. I wasn't sure. I was like, wait, no, I really try not to be pessimistic when somebody's starting something. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. That is not necessarily my social or political home. So we'll see how it galvanizes anybody. I'm not putting any of my eggs in a neoliberal basket. What I will say is that the ecosystem, I think that there is such ignorance of what the ecosystem really needs. And I think that you see what the right ecosystem is, and we want to mirror that. Democrats want to mirror that. And what is most needed is a bridge. And nobody's creating that bridge because Democrats are actually scared of the belly of the left. You know, I don't want to call it the base, but the belly, the appetite of the left. So there is none of that. Whereas on the right, you see people like Nick Fuentes being connected and bridged to people who are seen as more liberal on the right. To me, they're all white supremacists, but to see more liberal. But you see these bridges continuously being created with Steve Bannon being connected to Candace Owens. Like, you kind of see that. Here, it's not that. It is segregation. It is, we do not want to hear what those Bernie people have to say, what those radical Black people have to say. We don't want to hear none of that, but we will give people who are sycophants of our politicians a platform to hopefully yell people into voting. I don't know what the plan is there.
Or walk out of dates to force them to vote, yes.
Shame. Shame is a powerful motivator. You know, a part of me is like, I don't know what people want Kamala to do. It feels like everything she does is never the right thing for people. So it's like, if she disappears, then it's like, well, why give up? She has a long career left. If she runs for president again, it's like, wait, Miles, you're the disappear chart for her?
No. I would just say, I know what I want her to do.
Oh, I'm just, it's like, if she runs again, people are pissed about that. If she runs for governor, people... So I'm like, oh, I don't know. The part of me is like, Kamala can do no right for people. So that is... I struggle with that. What I will say is that there's no shortage of organizing infrastructure needed on the left. So if this helps to... I mean, this is like going to be some videos and stuff, she said. But if it becomes more than that, that will be necessary. And, you know, I think Miles has yelled this point for months, more than months, half a year maybe, about the party leaders being afraid of the belly or the far left or whatever we call it. And ICE is actually a really interesting moment around this because, and I'm going to talk about this later, but when you look at the polling for ICE, what you will see is that 85% of Democrats support abolishing ICE. Now, when I first saw this number, I was like, because the options are strongly support, somewhat don't support, strongly don't support. So when I saw it, my gut was like, oh, this is going to be majority of people somewhat supporting that we have lumped into a big number. I looked at the data. It is 65% of Democrats strongly support the abolition of ICE. That is a moved needle. That is an incredible thing. But you see the party leadership sort of like afraid of where people have moved. And I think that is true on a host of issues that we could frankly be fighting much harder on because our people are already there. We don't have to move them anymore. They're just there. And our leaders, for whether it's disconnect or money, they just are not doing it. And that is, it becomes more stark to me every day.
I wonder what you would have to hear from party leadership to know that they were finally moving in the direction of the base. I listened to an interview this morning with Speaker Jeffries talking about the Dems trying to hold the line on more funding for DHS as a way of forcing Republicans' hands on their demands related to ICE, namely body cameras, you know, ICE agents having to remove their masks, et cetera. And he didn't sound like he had moved anywhere near where the base is, right? And so I'm wondering, you know, do we think that this moment becomes another fracture line within the party where the base is, you know, closer to where we are on, like, let's say, Palestine, right? And where party leaders are, to your point, DeRay, for money or fear of being unseated, reluctant to move in that direction. And I'm just wondering what it sounds like to come from party leadership, right? Because I think some of them would say, we don't want to scare the moderates. We don't want to scare the middle, even though we will achieve the same outcomes you all are hoping for. And I'm wondering if we're asking for language and virtue signaling that actually means we won't get what we want. Like, what does it sound like to have party leadership say the right thing on this issue right now?
I don't know if I think there's much middle. I think that people sort of are picking sides. ICE is a good example to me. Is that when you get 80% combined of the Dems saying get rid of ICE, there's no middle. It is just a majority, right? So when you see people not meet it, you're like, well, what is happening? Because you're not messaging that the people are wrong. Like, you're not saying, oh, you believe this, but like, you didn't get it right. Like, that's not what they're saying. They just sort of aren't in line with it. Now, what I'm sensitive to, and I probably have a particular bias around this because I'm an organizer, is that the Dems can continue to do it when we don't have a sustained, organized sort of push against them. So they can release things that don't make sense. And unless you happen to have one of the organizers on a hot topic issue who just won't, like the Palestinian organizers just would not relent, and they sort of moved the needle. The people about AIPAC would not relent, and they just moved the needle. But outside of these sort of like very specific things, the Dems sort of do whatever. People tweet about it, and then they just move on, right? Because there is nothing sort of forcing them to do anything else. Do I think Kamala's going to do that? No. But when I think of what we need in the political space, that is what we need.
I think that they're not doing it because they know what I know, which is they kind of know like this kind of imminent Afro-pessimistic truth, which is that probably in 10 or 15 years, the people who are really going to be controlling them are the people on the far right. So they can't actually make these and totally align with the belly of their base because they know that that will upset the people who they're really going to have to serve. Now, midterms, we all know that conservatives do not come out during midterms. So I think what Democrats are seeing is that there is going to be a wave of conservatism, if we want to call it that. I'm calling it a wave of fascism. And I think them putting their heels inside of an issue like abolition would sabotage their chances of control in the future. So Kamala could not go on stage if she said abolition today, abolition tomorrow, when it comes to a police state or ICE, she could not then go on stage in 2 years and say, you're going to have the most lethal American system. She couldn't do all these kind of neoliberal fascist dog whistles that she does in order to maintain power. And I think all of the Democratic Party knows that. So they're kind of stuck inside of affordability. They're kind of stuck inside of these certain topics, because if they go any more radical or left on any of the other ones, they know that they'll probably end up being hated by the people who they're eventually going to try to court.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense.
I'm wondering if Texas, of all places, might offer us some insight and potential lessons here, right? So we've talked a lot about Jasmine Crockett's run for Senate, right? And how her messaging is landing on the electorate in that state. We've talked a lot about where we've been disappointed in some of the positions that Jasmine Crockett has taken on some of the third rail issues among the Democratic base. And now running to succeed her in her current House district is her pastor, who is running to her left on a lot of the third rail issues. And the Justice Dems, you know, who have seen success in supporting AOC and others, have endorsed him. And so I'm watching that race closely. I'm wondering how you all are thinking about and processing watching this Democrat who is deeply rooted in Christianity run to the left of someone who is already seen as radical in a party that we are talking about not having the appetite for that, and what you think his chances are, number one, and then two, again, what we think the national party might be able to learn from a candidate like him.
A, to me, it makes sense because, you know, Jesus is a far left radical. Like, Jesus is the most leftist you could, that has ever leftist. The throwing of the tables, the actual spiritual ideals, that's the fact that, like, oh, you do not need a king or a pharaoh or whatever they had in the biblical times. All you need is this connection to God, and that is the supreme connection that surpasses whatever laws and governments that this earth has. That's a kind of abolition of like government. That's a kind of anarchist idea. So it makes sense to me that we would birth people who both believed in Christianity and believed in like leftist politics. That feels really good to me. I am also astonished that Jasmine Crockett, I've been trying to at least, been so good on her since she's announced her running. I really had to shut my mouth. I tried not to throw any pessimism. When I saw that video of her defending somebody in the Epstein files, I'm like, have we not watched Shonda Rhimes? Did we not like, where is that cutthroat West Wing energy? If somebody who is your friend is in the Epstein file and you're trying to gain political power, throw that man under the bus. I don't know what's going on. Oh my goodness. Like, fake it. Like, I was, like, perplexed that she was on television defending somebody as she's trying to run for a Senate seat. And yeah. I also think that, like, the other critiques that I had before she ran for Senate and when she was kind of just in that kind of Marjorie Taylor viral clip, I really warned against just being sucked into this digital minstrelsy of being used as a way to just be seen as a neoliberal mascot for the Democratic Party and then being flattened. And I think now you actually see her kind of cultural limitations, and now out of all people, her own pastor is able to see that and say, oh, I know where you can't go. I know what you can't say. I know what you can't do. And I know what people are really thirsty for, and I'm willing to do it. That's, to me, a fascinating revelation that I didn't expect to see happen.
I'm curious, both of you, I know, I just have questions because we haven't talked about it. Do you think she has I don't know, where are you on the, like, and Miles, you have had a lot of thoughts about her over the arc, it's been great to, like, see.
Can you also highlight my restraint?
Yeah.
Have you seen my restraint? She announced, I was like.
You did. But I think about, like, you call this digital minstrelsy, like, the, like, you will become the trope. You named that a long time ago. Sharonda, do you think that sentiment has changed about her? Do you think that, you know, the polls still seem really close with her and Tallarico? It doesn't seem like there's a clear person. And then if she does get the nomination, do you think she can win? Or how do you think she's navigated the media? I'm interested, Sharonda, what you think? Like, people probably say different things around you than they say around me about her. I don't know.
Yeah, I, you know, am with Miles on the digital minstrelsy stuff, right? Like, I definitely saw some stuff come out of her office where I was like, Jasmine, people are dying. You know what I mean? Like, we don't need the rap video. And then I had to check in with myself to be like, have I adopted a respectability politic, right, that is not allowing me to like hear this woman's message because of how she's trying to deliver it. Also, I'm like, well, who is her target demographic? And is this way of communicating like hitting them? And I just need to acknowledge that like she's not trying to court the old respectable aunties, right? Which is my demo.
Not your demo. That is not your demo.
I think that I am struggling to see a path truly towards viability for her. What I am afraid we are seeing in some of the polling data that has her neck and neck with Tallarico is people not wanting to be perceived as racist, right? And it's the same thing that we've talked about with Kamala, which is like, you know, if you asked the party pollsters, if you asked, you know, the other folks who were trying to run the numbers, people were saying they were going to show up to vote for Kamala and like just didn't. In the numbers that, you know, that they said and numbers that she needed to win. And I'm deeply concerned that we might be seeing something similar with Jasmine, which is like, in this moment, no one wants to be called racist, right? In this moment, no one wants to say that they are undermining a Black woman if they consider themselves as part of the left. But I'm just worried what people will do once they are in those ballots, you know, in those voting booths and they pull that curtain behind them. And I'm trying not to give voice to that. I'm trying not to give energy to that. I'm trying to believe that we can win. I'm trying to believe, as she said, that like the only way we do it is to do it. But two of my siblings live in Texas, right? Both of them are partnered. And I talk to both of them all of the time. And she has not come up, you know, at all as somebody that they are thinking about supporting. They haven't even expressed excitement around her candidacy. And one of my siblings is raising two Black girls in Texas, right? And is constantly looking for Black women to elevate to, you know, say like, that could be you one day. And Jasmine isn't making the cut. Yikes, can't believe I said that. But that's, yeah.
I was so curious because I don't think I have deep thoughts about this. Like I'm sort of like soaking this in because I only see her on Twitter and on Instagram at this point. Like, and I see, I don't know what idea she has. I just see her respond to things. That's like the clips that go viral, her sort of in response to something. So I need to do more homework. That is on me.
Or maybe you don't, because according to James Carville, all we need is a white candidate who will get Black people to have his way.
I said, you old Creole skeleton tour crypt keeper. Why would you? And well, also that reveals, too, is how we got into this neoliberal fascist mess, right? Mm. Because James Carville was the advisor, yes, of Bill Clinton. And yes, Bill Clinton was the one who went on playing saxophone. I'm reading a Arsenio, I was but a star in the sky. But also, I've been reading this book. We're going to actually have this author on. So I've been reading this book on Toni Morrison. And she starts it with Toni Morrison's failures when it came to like essay writing, which is kind of scary. And one of her failures is she really put it on for Bill Clinton in a way that was,
she did,
was really weird and untrue.
She did. She did. She's who christened him the first Black president.
Ooh, yikes.
Yeah.
It makes sense that he would say something like that when you think about the representations that we got. And then when you think about Barack Obama and like the creation that is, and I don't think that you get Barack Obama without the launching pad of Bill Clinton. And also the launching pad of Bill Clinton's failures of like Monica Lewinsky and stuff. I think that he helps make the bar really low publicly, that Obama's exceptionalism was able to sit really beautifully on top of that, because we did Bill Clinton. This white trash man from Arkansas was in there getting fellatio in the White House. Mm-hmm. We can't let this exceptional Negro in the White House with a white mom. Like, it kind of made the negotiation different, I think, too. But yeah, I think that we're in like the aftermath of a lot of those dangerous decisions and a lot of those engineering around what America really has to do to really be a place that is sustainable, a place that is safe, and a place that is equitable.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come. Pod Save the People is brought to you by Americans United for Separation of Church and State. Hey, what's the most slept on part of the First Amendment? Any guesses? Well, it's the Establishment Clause, the whole freedom of and from religion thing. you know, Project 2025, all this stuff is really involved with the Establishment Clause. The threat of Christian nationalism and rampant misuse of religious freedom is all over the place. If you're looking for tools on how to fight back against this, or just want to nerd out with other organizers, lawyers, policymakers, and folks inspired to protect freedom of and from religion, check out the Summit for Religious Freedom, or SRF, SRF. It's the leading event for anyone passionate about defending religious freedom, church-state separation, and the many critical rights that depend on them, taking place April 25th to 27th in Washington, D.C., and online. SRF brings together advocates from all walks of life, religious and non-religious, and organizes decades of experience and folks just getting introduced to this work. SRF stands as a united front to protect LGBTQ plus rights, reproductive rights, public schools, and the values that uphold our democracy. At its core, SRF is about collaboration. It's an opportunity to learn from thought leaders and experts working in government, grassroots organizing, and nonprofits focused on religious freedom. It's a big tent movement confronting the growing threats of Christian nationalists and extremists working to force their narrow beliefs on everybody. Together, attendees strategize, learn, and build the momentum needed to preserve equality, freedom, and democracy for all. Learn more about how you can get involved in this critical fight by visiting thesrf.org. This podcast is sponsored by Strawberry.me. Let me ask you something. You think LeBron, Patrick Mahomes, or Serena got the GOAT status by guessing? No, they're coaching. Every pro athlete has a specialized coach watching their form, calling the plays, and finding the blind spots they can't see themselves. That's exactly how they win championships. And I'll tell you, I didn't get to the place that I'm at in my career and the work alone. I had the most incredible teachers and people guiding me, adults, pushing me and challenging me to be my best my whole life. So why are you trying to win in your career without a coach? You're grinding away, hoping for a promotion, trying to guess the right moves. That's amateur hour. You need a strategist. You need Strawberry.me. Strawberry.me matches you with a professional career coach who breaks down your game film. They help you negotiate that raise, navigate the politics, and execute a game plan that actually works. And the cost? Think about it. One raise, one promotion, and this coaching pays for itself 10 times over. That's the best ROI in the game. Stop riding the bench on your life. Go to strawberry.me/PSTP today to get 50% off your first coaching session. Strawberry.me, because pros don't guess, they get coached to win.
The Grammys were this past Sunday, so we got to see who the award winners are. There was some history made this year at the Grammys with Bad Bunny winning Album of the Year for the first time as like an artist who had made a fully Spanish language album for Debí Tirar Más Fotos. So, you know, we watched all the looks on the red carpet. I had like a whole little thread going with my friends about what that looked like. We saw some people choose to get on stage and leverage the moment to make political commentary on the state of the country. We saw a lot of people also choose not to do that, right? We saw Trevor Noah make some jokes about things that he has admitted he might not have made if he planned to return to host the Grammys in the future, but he has announced this is his last year doing it. But I'm curious about like what's sticking for y'all, what albums might be in heavy rotation that you've gone back to revisit after seeing, you know, who won this year. Yeah, Miles, kick us off as our resident cultural critic.
As with everything, I think that I have, you know, yin and yang. So I want to start with like the positivity first. I know that we are a podcast for a Black audience, obviously, or from a Black perspective, rather. But I do want to mention Lady Gaga. I think Lady Gaga has, I think Mayhem is a really brilliant pop album. Like, y'all know that, like, my bread and butter, how I started writing was about music. I love music. I think sonically it is so courageous, so interesting. And then because she's a woman who is in her late 30s now, the fact that she, to me, she is making the most bold music, not just of her career, but the most bold music when you think about other girls who are 10 years younger than her, I think it's really, really exciting. But also because she performed, and we know that she deals with this disability. If you watch her documentary, she deals with this disability that just paralyzes her whole body and puts her whole body in pain. And you actually see in her performances, both in concert and in the Grammys, her working around that disability and that disability actually generating like really interesting choices when it comes to performance and when it comes to dance and when it comes to what she does. And when I think about the disability community and people seeing that, oh, I might have a chronic illness or chronic pain, or whatever, that you can still be a person who's a part of performance, you know? The other part is, oh, those are y'all some class traitors. Y'all some class traitors. I was so excited to see, I'm a big fan of Zach Campbell. So I was watching Zach Campbell in his review, and that was, to me, was better just because I love Zach Campbell and I think that he's just hilarious and I've just been a fan for a long time. But like watching people or watching these people go on the Grammys, it feels really weird. Post Epstein, post a second Trump era, just all the bullshit. Like, post all of that, to see people still feel compelled to legitimize this force that, like, we use to, like, qualify ourselves, it just really feels like, oh, some people, speaking of Roberta Flack, who was honored, she has a song called Go Down Moses, where she says, Black people let Pharaoh go. Like, I think we need to let Pharaoh go. And I think that it's always disappointing to see people like Kendrick Lamar, honestly, even like Lauryn Hill, legitimize a white supremacist capitalist institution like the Grammys, specifically now when you don't need to. Out of all the people in the world, y'all can totally dominate culture without legitimizing these white supremacist capitalist forces. But that lets me know that more than practical, it's psychic and it's something in your head. But just to put a bow on it, love Lauryn Hill's performance. It was beautiful. The fact that they got to honor Angie Stone, D'Angelo, and Roberta Flack, I thought it was beautiful. Bilal coming out, Layla Hathaway, just some of our best living musicians were on that stage. Rafael Sadiq, and then also, you know, Kendrick Lamar with those 16 Grammys. But I don't need Nobel Peace Prize. I don't need the Grammys. I don't need nobody to tell me that Kendrick Lamar is in the tradition of a Langston Hughes or The Last Poets, and he is one of the most amazing artists that we've have seen and been graced with. I don't need a white supremacist capitalist institution to legitimize what I already know, because I trust the legitimizing force are my eardrums. The legitimizing force is my brain, not no gold award or statue.
I don't know if you all saw that Ketanji was in the audience, because she was nominated for Best Audiobook Narration and Storytelling Recording for her memoir, Lovely One. She did not win. She lost to the Dalai Lama. But what is...
Not a bad person to lose.
Yeah,
you know.
But there was a call from Senator Marsha Blackburn to investigate Ketanji for her attendance at the Grammys, because she said, and I quote, "To have justices of our nation's highest court been present at an event at which attendees have amplified such far-left rhetoric," is what she's flagging in a formal letter from her office to the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And I'm like, oh, I just wanted to bring that here, because I don't know if you all saw that.
Good for them. Good. Good. And I hope, you know, like I'm at the point now where I hope they keep on giving these neoliberal institutionalists hell, because if you actually let far left people inside of the media sphere, if you actually platform people who are actually on the far left and who actually said some shit that makes your stomach kind of turn a little bit, then they wouldn't be able to say that about y'all. Just like we have like all this this huge landscape of like, well, Nick Fuentes is not like Charlie Kirk, and Charlie Kirk is not like J.D. Vint, and we have all this stuff. Y'all totally eliminated that. So all y'all little neoliberal, please, squish ice, please, all of that stuff, now that's seen as far left. Good. Hope you learned something. Hope it's starting to click.
So that was interesting. Shout out to Lauryn Hill. She was on time. It was beautiful.
Allegedly, it's pre-recorded.
Right. Bilal was great. I thought that part was beautiful. I mean, sans the, like, why are we still participating? Oh, and Daryl Walls. If you remember the Walls? Like, the Walls group, the kids that, mm-hmm. I mean, they're adults now, but the gospel group. Daryl Walls won. Him and PJ Morton won a Grammy. And I've always loved the
Duran Bernard.
Duran. Yeah, and that moment was just great for Duran. Yeah. And then Kehlani. Kehlani had won before.
The people love Kehlani.
And you know, I do like that girl, Lola, who sings that song, I'm like messy or whatever it is. She just, there's so much pain and stuff going on where I like her.
Before we move on, can I just say one little thing about Duran Bernard?
Yeah.
So moons ago, when I was in Atlanta and I was writing for an independent magazine, I got to interview Duran Bonnar with, he was literally staying with a friend, Bosco, and he was there and I got to interview him. And he just began doing background vocals for Erykah Badu. And we had a really great interview, and he's such a sweetheart. And I was already a fan of him because I'm an internet kid. So I was already following him when he was Alcohol Harmony on YouTube and all this other stuff. So even then, I was like 19 maybe. But like even then, it felt like a full circle moment because I was watching him since I was like 14 or 15. And just to see him come into his own, to see him totally just be himself and kind of preserve this funk, Afrocentric, Afrofuturistic aesthetic and sensibility that we see so many people abandoning for like more fascist aesthetics. It was really beautiful to see. Like, you know, I too have a neoliberal beating heart and I'm sentimental about stuff too. So I had to turn off my radical brain and say, you better get it, sister.
And he was so happy.
So happy.
Up to the stage.
So happy.
How can you, that's what's so dangerous about it, because how can you really hate something like that? You really don't hate something like that, but you gotta learn to.
There you go. If y'all can see Miles point at the camera,
but you gotta learn to.
That was great.
Well, Miles, picking up on a thing that you just said about, like, you know, the composition of the media space and who is a journalist and who isn't. Also happening this week, massive layoffs at the Washington Post and what the Atlantic has called the murder of the paper, and what lots of other people have said is an example of a billionaire doing the bidding, not just of this administration, but of the billionaire class, to ensure that there are no investigative reporters, that there are no photojournalists, that there's no one covering what the U.S. is doing here or abroad. You know, numbers I've seen so far say that about 300 people have been laid off at the Washington Post, that they've shuttered entire sections, so no more sports. They've, you know, killed their podcast, no more book reviews. We've seen people who are abroad covering active armed conflict and war say, like, got fired while I'm here, you know? And, you know, obviously I want to talk about WAPO in specific, but I would also love to talk about what this means more generally for the state of journalism and media, particularly print media in the U.S. I'm also thinking about the fact that, like, the LA Times, right, my hometown paper, was also bought recently by a billionaire who decided not to run the editorial board's endorsement of Kamala, as an example, right? And people are like, Bezos, what's going on? You're the business guy, number one. And number two, if you were really committed to a paper, you know, living up to its slogan, which is democracy dies in the dark, even if the paper weren't profitable, you could subsidize it, right? So we're not buying the this is a business decision justification that we might buy if someone else were owner of the paper. So yeah, want to talk about it. And I know those of you who are connected to writers, et cetera, even freelance writers, right? That's like one less place where people have an opportunity to make a living as a journalist or a writer in whatever capacity they might do that work.
You know, when I think about the Washington Post, it just is a stark reminder that the right is playing a not even long-term media game. It's very short-term, and they are doing it swiftly in a way that is, like, supposed to make you unbalanced. So it's like CBS turned quickly. Like, Barry Weiss came in there, and this was not like a 6-month, 12-month shift. It was a, like, 2-week, I'm getting y'all out of here. We changing this up. Da-da-da. And if you don't like it, leave. And, like, that happened. Yep. The Washington Post, it's like, we are firing. I don't know if you saw the way they did it. They sent all the employees an email that said, please stay home. We have something going on, but sign on to Zoom. Like, do not nobody come into the office. That's how they fired everybody.
Yep.
And I have some friends who got laid off, and they are mailing the stuff from the office. Anything on your desk, they are mailing to your house. Like, and this is clearly not about money. It's owned by people who can afford all of these things. The Washington Post has a subscription base, and, you know, they do well. So this has been swift, and they're really thoughtful about it. If anything, when I think about thoughtful as in, like, they are planning this out, not thoughtful as in, like, morally good. I think the crisis that I'm interested in that I don't have an answer for is the blurring the line between the journalists and the influencers, which I think will continue to create chaos. As somebody who works in organizing and I sort of need people to know enough of what's true so I can get them to do something or not. The amount of influencers who just sort of get people on a path that I can't do anything with immediately is sort of frustrating. And that is something I'm dealing with. Like, I remember, obviously, I was one of the, you know, first people on Twitter to do the thing I did the way I did it. There weren't a ton of people sort of using social media like that around organizing. But I even think about people I won't name who, like, went to Minneapolis for 5 hours to record content to make a whole series video. And they're sort of, like, talking about ICE in ways that you're like, I don't really know if that's right. Like, this is sort of weird. But it's happening with all the content. And you get the Don Lemons, who is, you know, he is a legitimate journalist who's not on a major network anymore, but he is few and far between of the people who are on sort of Instagram, using Instagram in that way. Mm-hmm. Miles and you know, Sharana, y'all know YouTube. There's probably some smart people on YouTube. I don't know those people. I really just know Twitter and Instagram. I think the end of big media in this way will lead to a really intense blurring of the line between influencers and journalists. And I think the public will experience them as the same. And I think we will lose in that scenario.
What I find most sinister about this is, the best way I can map this is on my own life, right? So since moving, I've been able to, of course, like, find even more, like, economic stability, but then also get a loft space and kind of do these things that are in my head, because so much of the barrier to your ideas is around, A, getting in front of people to let people know that it exists, and also having the capital to make it happen, right? So when I specifically think, like, what's a Black neighborhood in D.C.? Whatever, let's say Chocolate City. Black journalists, Black women, even people, even outside of race or whatever, because I know Washington Post was not just brimming with Black people. There actually should be so many millionaires who are excited about this because now they can fund something. There's actually enough millionaires. There's enough Black millionaires. There's enough people with capital. There's enough people with third or fourth homes that could actually fund a project, both small, medium, and big, to make this the worst decision Washington Post ever made and the right ever made. But what's sinister about it, post-Epstein, is that, oh, I think there's a reason why we do not see those things being funded, because the people even who are seen on the liberal left are still colluding with the fascist right, and they don't want to amplify right politics or good journalism too. But there's actually so much opportunity. When I see things like this happen, the shame is not that they got fired. The shame is that there are not infrastructures looking to gather them up and to make new presses that are actually competitive in the digital market. Like, the spirit of Ida B. Wells is frowning. Sometimes, and this is me being, like, internet brain too, is, like, we see so many people flaunt their wealth through materialism, which is such a, like, psychic distortion, because we know that, like, when Rupert Murdoch wanted power, he created the New York Post. Like when these people want power, they take over press. And it breaks my brain a little bit, the idea that people who actually could start something that's significant choose a trip to Bali or a fourth home or think so small of themselves.
Yeah, I think the thing that I'm struggling with is, and that I've seen other people talk about, is like how we as consumers can also demonstrate demand for kind of what you're talking about, Miles, right? And it's like, you know, I give my little money to The Intercept. I give my little money to, you know, ProPublica, whatever, right? But like, everybody can get $7 to $19 a month from me, right? So like, how do we, and like, I can't read everybody's Substack, right? And it takes so long for reporters and news agencies to build up the kind of credibility and infrastructure to do the kind of reporting that matters to people. I don't know that like consumer-driven demand will be enough to sustain a lot of the projects that we care about, right? So like in Los Angeles, there's this media outlet called LA Taco. And literally they started as like an outlet that was reporting on the best tacos in the city, right? And so I'm like, yes, absolutely. Like I'm in. And now they have become the number one outlet for reporting on ICE activity. So they do this thing every day called the Daily Briefing, and they share it on their Instagram, and they're just like, here's where ICE was across, you know, LA and the surrounding cities. And in order for them to be able to do that, they've had to go to institutional funders, right? Because my little $7 a month subscription to LA Taco was not enough for them to afford to like pay their team to do these daily briefings, right? And so I'm like, well, I could, you know, cancel my WAPO and give that extra money to LA Taco, right? But then the work of like trying to get an organization to a place where like if someone walked up to you and they were like, hi, I'm here from LA Taco and I want to talk to you about what you think of the future of the Democratic Party, like, does that even make sense to you, right? Like the work that a news agency has to do to build a brand and credibility and presence in the space to get the kind of access, right, that then allows them to report on the things that are meaningful takes a while. And like, while I understand that value and I have the extra $23, right, that I'm now going to redirect to LA Taco, like that's not the case for everybody. You know what I mean? And I'm wondering how we do this that's also absent from the people who have, and because the moneyed people are also going to have a moneyed agenda, right?
My pushback, and I wish I remember the philosopher's name. He's alive, but he talks about like giving. He talks about like the virtue of giving. And he also talks about politically what people should be giving and what people should be doing. So my big thing about it is, and this is how come I kind of see that there's going to be kind of like more violence that happens that is more obscure, because for many people, what it would take to sustain a platform or to sustain certain projects is a rounding error for them. So it doesn't need to be about money. And it's not until you figure out there are more important things than money, then it'll be a wake-up call, because there are going to be people who are so desperate that they're going to come to your neighborhoods. Then you're going to have to get, you know, I was watching an interview with Trump yesterday, and he talked about how that White House was so decked out and how the roof is different and it's drone resistant and the walls are different and all this other stuff. And he was being oddly vulnerable about how scared he is for his life. And I think that everybody else who finds themselves above $100,000, as much as that not is, should be scared as well. And it can't all be about, oh, how does this money make more money? It's how does this money create an ecosystem where I'm not a walking target, where this surveillance system doesn't leak my information and now everybody's celebrating my Luigi. You know what I mean? Like, I think that is where people are going to have to get with it. It can't always be about profit and greed. It has to be about actually having a plan for an ecosystem that does not let fascism win. And that to me is like an odd thing. And the last thing I'll say too, and this is kind of a little bit of a push for you, Sharonda, and I'm so excited to hear about Campaign Zero and their Substack release, and I hope that it's a beginning of like more of that media apparatus, is that I think that sometimes when people are in positions of power, they continue to think like consumers and not like producers. So I know for a fact that you know how to get money in ways that your average Black woman does not know how to make money. So when's the last time you talked to somebody who's making $30,000, $40,000, $20,000 about how to make money? So it's not always about, because yeah, you're right, how much $23 here, da-da-da-da there. If you're just a consumer trying to change things to consumption, you're going to find a limit. But to me, it's about how do I, A, maybe use my privileges to be a producer of something, and what experts or what connections do I have to be able to do that? And how do I release the knowledge that I have to somebody else who may never touch the rooms that I've touched and understand what I touch? How do I connect those class bridges in real life? But yeah, I do agree with you that if it's just about consumption, then yeah, that's never going to work.
Yeah, I think that's a right and fair push. Hold me accountable to not just having an answer, but to having evidence of what I've done to share more about what I know and bridge and provide people access. I think, you know, we've talked a lot about money, how people think about money, how people think about, you know, upward economic mobility. And one big way that people have tried to do that, at least recently, in a way that is becoming more publicly visible, is through gambling or prediction markets. and hoping to strike it big. We have been talking a lot about Polymarket and Kaushi, current obsessions of mine. And Polymarket recently hosted a free grocery store pop-up in New York. And when it got shared in the group chat, right, I think all of us were like, what's the other shoe that's about to drop here? And then the other shoe dropped a couple days later. DeRay, tell us about what we learned about Polymarket as a result of their big charity washing attempt.
So let me be honest and say that when I first saw the news, I didn't realize it was a pop-up. I was like, oh, they have a grocery store, because that's how I first saw it. So even sneakier, the pop-up.
That's good marketing.
They got me. Because I saw it in past. I was like, oh, this is wow. Polymarket is being sued. They being sued. This was a part of the PR to get in front of the press when I'm being sued. So when you Google Polymarket, you're going to see way more articles about this free grocery store pop-up than you see about the fraud. But Sharonda, I wouldn't have even known about Kaushi Polymarket if not for you. But here is, I want to connect something that we've talked about before. This is like, it will sound like a tangent, but this is, Miles, one of your ancient talking points, ancient in a good way, you've been saying it for a long time, is that one of the, I think one of the Kaushi people is a former Obama lawyer. And there was this whole critique of like, what happens when the Obama people, the people who like, you know, go work at Airbnb and Uber, and places like Kaushi, you know, it leads people to say, oh, there might actually not be so much distinction between the parties that we thought there were. That like, this might be a matter of like, do you think I should die today or do you think I should die in 10 years? But like, sort of death is sort of coming. And when I saw that the other day and looking at some of the Polymarket lawsuit stuff, I was like, oh, this is sort of interesting because you get this cast of characters who have done legitimately good stuff in the world in a different administration. They really have. And sort of the forces of capitalism or whatever sort of entice people into these positions and places where it's like, well, we both know that this isn't right. And the Polymarket Kaushis have done that to people. And I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah.
So my post-Epstein mind is a little bit different than my pre-Epstein mind. And I think that is mainly around morals and law. What's the wildest part of the Epstein files for me is, you know, I used to like joke on here about people believing like people are eating babies and stuff like that. That's in the files. I'm like, what? Now that I'm thinking in this mind, I'm like, well, why not start Bet on America? If you're going to abuse people, if you're going to have people in these precarious financial situations, why not America, that's already the predator, be just mask off and create Bet on America, a betting ecosystem, and then make a free grocery store or make a place where you can get drugs or your prescription drugs and they be free or damn near near like wholesale. What is this fascination with law and order when the people who are running not just this nation and this world are doing the most unthinkable things? Like literally there are things in those Epstein files that I didn't even connect, and I am an Edgar Allan Poe fan. I'm a Toni Morrison fan, and I've never even thought of those things. I'm in like little, you can't see me, I'm in a black room right now. Like darkness is hello darkness, my old friend. But like, I never thought, anywho, I don't necessarily understand the position, the moral position of people not willing to just do what you know that's going to keep America from being in a desperate place that's going to end up in like a lot of violence.
And did y'all see Bill Gates sort of say very publicly, he's like, I regret everything I did every time I was around Epstein. And Melinda is
not satisfied.
She really isn't. And I love it. Melinda's like, shouldn't have been there. Bad. You know, because the wives always have to go on the I still love you tour.
Yeah.
And she's like, I'm off the tour. She said, you on your own on that one. I can't explain it. Shame. And I love that about Melinda.
I have always said that the Democrat Party, for these reasons, are very radioactive. Now, I cannot concede. Like, we all know that Bill Clinton is the predator because we know Monica Lewinsky. So now that we look back on it, it's very obvious that he's a predator. And then even the other women that he was accused of sexually assaulting, you know, watching the Monica Lewinsky documentary, reading the books, I was having an era where I was, like, really obsessed with that era in time and OJ and stuff like that. I had no idea just how many people were accusing Bill Clinton of sexual harassment and assault outside of Monica Lewinsky. And the fact that not only is Hillary trying to run for something or trying to be in our face on Netflix, but also you bringing Bill Clinton to Arkansas, like, that is so wild. And I love that Melinda A got her ass out and said no. And then also is distancing from her because that really does something politically, because a lot of politics is cultural and emotional. And I'll just tie it up. The Democrats need to fight each other. The Democrats need to call each other disgusting, need to throw each other under the bridge. They need to do all of that before they even think about touching anything Trump got going on or anything the right has going on. They need to eat each other and then see who survives that digestion. And those will be powerful leaders.
Why do you think that? What? Because you think it'll, like, clear the riffraff.
I don't even just think that it will clear the riffraff because, like, Chuck Schumer's in these files, right? With and I'm not just naming people who are in the files. I'm naming people who are in the files and attached to very nefarious, odd emails that sound like they were participating in some stuff, allegedly to me, from what I saw with my eyes, to me, allegedly to me. Please don't sue. So I think that not only may it can, like, kind of eliminate the riffraff, which could do something, but I don't think that that's all how people stay in power politically. I think it might also make people trust the people who are upset with other people, if that makes sense. If AOC is now enemy to all these other disgusting, powerful pedophiles, I then like AOC even more. If Jasmine Crockett is that, instead of actually defending people.
Yeah, I think in listening to Miles' last point, what I hear is a point that they make all the time, which is, like, sometimes I think it's hard to distinguish between who's on what side of this issue. And we use sort of the party binary as a way of doing that when increasingly it's becoming clear everything from, like, where U.S. citizens are detained abroad to people's cozy relationships with Epstein, that the elite are the elite. And party affiliation is not the distinguishing identity factor marker that we hope it would be.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Acorns. There's not much you can do about the money you've got now, but if you want to do something about the money you could have tomorrow, Acorns wants to help. And with Acorns Potential Screen, you can find out what your money is capable of. Acorns is a smart way to give your money a chance to grow, and it's easy. You can sign up in minutes and start automatically investing your spare money, even if spare money is all you got. And Acorns grows with you. Whether you're just starting out or thinking about settling down, Acorns supports your big and small goals across every life stage. And Acorns is all in one. No more finance apps cluttering up your phone. With Acorns, you can invest, save, and give your money a chance to grow in one trusted place. And the Acorns Potential Screen shows you the power of compounding and how your money could grow over time. Plus, you can quickly adjust how much you're investing every week, day, month, to make sure you're building towards your goals. Sign up now and Acorns will boost your new account with a $5 bonus investment. Join the over 14 million all-time customers who have already saved and invested over $27 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/PSDP or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 2 compensation provided. Potential subject to various factors such as customers' accounts, age, and investment settings. Does not include Acorns fees. Results do not predict or represent the performance of any Acorns portfolio. Investment results will vary. Investing involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/PSTP. This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, sometimes it can feel like everybody else has it all together with their love lives, whether married, dating, or single. The truth is, most of us are still figuring it out and finding our way. And no matter where you are in your romantic journey, therapy can help you find your way. Help you determine what you want, what feels heavy, and how you can take some pressure off yourself. And here's the thing. February is a lot of pressure. It's Valentine's Day. It's flowers, stuffed animals. You know, there's a lot of talk about relationships and dating because of Valentine's Day. And no matter where you are, whether you're married or dating or single, just focusing on you, you're right on time. And again, therapy can help you find your way. And for me, you know, I've been trying to figure out what I want to do in a relationship. Like, what does that mean? Am I dating? Am I not dating? And therapy's been really powerful to have just somebody not in my life to talk to about all these things, especially with regard to relationships. And that's why I recommend BetterHelp. BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the U.S. And BetterHelp has a great matching system. There's a short questionnaire that helps identify your needs and preferences, and their 12-plus years of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means that they typically get it right on the first time. If you aren't happy with your match, you can switch to different therapists at any time from their tailored recommendations. And with over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, having served over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. Sign up and get 10% off at betterhelp.com/people. That's betterhelp.com/people.
Speaking of teams and their cultural and political influence, the Super Bowl is this coming Sunday as we are recording on a Friday. And it is what many people are affectionately calling Benito Bowl because people are excited to see Bad Bunny. But it is also happening against the backdrop of the NFL hiring zero Black head coaches, despite having a record number of openings for head coach positions, and despite having a majority still Black player base. And I know we joke often when we talk about sports on this podcast that we're not sports ball people, but to the extent that sports offer a window and a mirror, honestly, onto our broader culture, it felt important to bring this to the pod to discuss what it means to have had a record number of opportunities for teams to hire Black people into the number one spot and for no team to opt to do so. DeRay, we're going to start with you on this one.
I always have to remember that the Rooney Rule, which is the rule that forces NFL teams to interview Black people or like people of color for coaching roles, I forgot that it comes on the heels of Johnny Cochran suing the NFL. Mm-hmm. And that matters because if you think that they just sat around and were like, you know what, let's do what's right, that's a very different thing. Then you're like, oh no, they were trying to avoid a crazy lawsuit from the most famous lawyer in the country at the time, who also was Black and super cared about Black things. So he was ready to fight. You know, you get some lawyers who won't even stand up to the NFL, and Johnny Cochran's like, I'm Johnny Cochran, and we could do this all day, yesterday, tomorrow, and in the future. And then you get the Rooney Rule, and, you know, it just hasn't turned out to produce much. I went down a rabbit hole and also had to remind myself, I forgot that the owners select the commissioner and sort of run the commission, so the owners are really, there's no outside anything at the NFL. Right. So I was looking at like what solutions could there be, and there's some interesting ones. The Yale Law Review has some interesting things about the NFL that they have proposed. For instance, having an outside auditor come in and audit the hiring practices of teams so that there at least is some sort of outside validation that is not just the NFL staff coming in and saying what happened. You obviously know that nepotism is a huge part of the way that mm-hmm. the culture of the NFL works for the staff, not for players. Insert Deion Sanders here. but... You know, he worked overtime to make that happen. But for staff, nepotism, you know, the nepotism of white leaders is just incredible in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And all the data has shown that there's nothing about merit or time. Like, that's not what's happening here. So I thought those structural things were interesting. But I don't know what happens when you get a class of people who also have decided who can own what team. It's not, you know, to another point made earlier, there are a lot of rich people out here, and there are people who could, there have to be Black people who could buy, who could be majority owners in teams today, but you have to get permission to buy a part of a team. You have to get permission, you know, this is not, mm-hmm. this is not a marketplace. So when they talk about a free market, like this is, you know, this is also the scam of capitalism. None of it is the mm-hmm. theory, but, you know, the NFL is not a free market. It's not the person with the money who can afford it. You have to be invited in to buy, and that means mm-hmm. that it just is a closed circuit. And I don't judge people's decisions around settlements. So when Colin sued the NFL and settled, I always wonder what would have come out if he had not. Because they clearly blackballed him and, you know, he settled. The NFL had an interest in settling. So whatever they uncover would not come out. But I'm sure that was something to read and watch and see.
So I always skirted around talking about like why exactly I don't like sports, specifically football, because, you know, kind of lying and just like saying like, I don't know why I just don't like it. But I really wasn't sure if I would be able to articulate it. And I think I'm able to articulate it now. But if I can't, please cut it out. but I think to me, the aesthetics of football is so obviously a relic of chattel slavery. So I'm not the first person to make that connection of seeing like, oh, black men giving up their bodies in order for white men to gain more and more capital. And now there is a money exchange, but because of financial illiteracy, and then also because the habit of black people or the black cultural habit of wealth not transferring family to family, it still feels like that kind of ongoing relic. And even now, you know, as much as I love Michael Jackson, he's one of our most seductive neoliberal minstrels. So the fact that he started the Super Bowl halftime, and now that there are more people who are legitimizing this force, making it relevant with their talent, I don't see any use of it. I think that it's all bad. And I think that this just feels, again, I feel like I said this before too, but this feels like a recalcification of what this was meant to be. It was not meant to be a route or a pathway to Black freedom or Black equity. It was meant to be an exploitative practice. And hey, you can't whip these men anymore. You can't own these bucks anymore. But here's a sport where you can do it, and we will still look like sophisticated people to our ancestors across the pond and our peers over here. So here's what this is. And I feel like that recalcification is just what we're seeing. This is where neoliberalism is smart. Because when you have that one or two Negroes who are able to do it, then you can't say nothing because, oh my God, Brown Dante got it, or Johnson got it. So I don't want to say nothing because a black man getting it is so great, and we don't want to tear the black man down. Now there ain't no black men doing it. Now can we tear it down? That's how I generally like feel about this whole football situation.
Yeah, the NFL remains a really interesting cultural force for a host of reasons, right? I last fall took my then 14-year-old niece to her first NFL game. It was a Rams game. And neither of us know anything about football, but I'm the auntie who makes sure that the kids have all the experiences that they're supposed to have, right? And so, like, this was an experience it felt like she needed to have. And in the interest of full transparency, I'm going to be watching the halftime show on Sunday. You know what I mean? I'm curious to know what Bad Bunny does. I'm curious about all the conversation around having selected him as the halftime show headliner. And that means that the NFL is going to get my, you know, my views. And for a couple of years, I didn't. And then honestly, I felt like I was the last person in my orbit who was like, I'm not watching the NFL because the NFL is on the wrong side of the Black issues that I care about. It felt like nobody actually was boycotting. You know what I mean? And NFL Sunday is an American cultural mainstay. And Super Bowl Sunday especially, you know? And it feels really difficult to opt out. And I know I'm saying that on a podcast where, you know, people are going to be like, girl, just turn off your TV. but I want to watch. Like, I'm not going to lie. I want to watch, you know? Like, I do. I'm curious. I want to see. I enjoy Bad Bunny. I want to sing in the living room. I want to do all the things. And I'm going to. So, yeah.
That's kind of the neoliberal paradox we find ourselves in, right? That's the neoliberal paradox. So it's like, but just to kind of correct you, because I'm a geek about this, it's not a cultural mainstay. It was created that way. It was created because In Living Color was seceding, and then Michael Jackson it then created it. So just like Black people created it being a mainstay, we can end it being a mainstay. But it feels like I've been like playing in my head. I think we're going to be known as like the Maria Antoinette generation, meaning a generation of people who like wanted their conveniences and their pleasures and their bread and circuses, like the leftists would say, more than they wanted their own revolution. And we will be a generation that really regrets not doing something a little bit sooner, not logging off Spotify, Netflix a little bit sooner, because we were hoping that like a kind of neoliberal Barack Obama shaped hero would kind of save us and make it so we can have our streaming services and our AI and our lives. And I think that we're not gonna be able to have it all. But you know, I'll be watching Bad Bunny too. I'm not saying I'm better than y'all. I'm just saying, I just have to be real about what's going on.
Well, speaking of Black men and their treatment under oppressive systems, my news this week is about the growing gap between life without parole sentences between Black and white defendants in San Diego. I'm bringing this to the pod really for two reasons. One is I don't think that people often understand the discretion that prosecutors have when they're charging people and deciding to add on special circumstances, or as they are called in California, right? That essentially mean that people, if they're convicted, will be sentenced to life without parole. I'm also bringing it because I have thought about part of my job on this pod to be disabusing people of the notion that California is a liberal place and a liberal haven. And I want us to talk about what it means also when prosecutors' offices don't have to share data around the plea deals they agree to, the decisions or data that are leading to these disproportionate outcomes, and when they can be tied almost directly to whoever the district attorney is. Really quickly want to read part of this before I turn it over for discussion. Under former San Diego District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis, Black people were about 5 times more likely than white people to face life without parole through the special circumstances of felony murder. Under the current district attorney, Summer Stephen, he said that rose to about 23 times more likely. And so when there's that degree of discretion at the DA level, right, when you're seeing this level of discrepancy between who gets sentenced to life without parole, again, under the special circumstance of felony murder and who doesn't, it feels like this is an opportunity for us to interrogate how our systems are designed, how all of these attempts at curbing what we have called implicit bias through mandatory minimums, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, might actually be having the exact opposite outcome that we had hoped for. But again, wanted to bring this to make sure that people were aware that this is like an ongoing trend in the United States, and especially that this is an ongoing trend in a place like California that people think of as a liberal bastion.
I'll just say, you know, we have a campaign at Campaign Zero that is focused on parole, and most people are focused on probation in this space. So there's not a lot of structural changes that are happening to parole, but the parole system in California changed dramatically in the 70s, essentially wiping out parole for anybody who gets like a determinate sentence. Like if you get sentenced to X number of years, you essentially don't have access to parole. So if you get sentenced to a range of years or a life sentence, then you do get access to parole. But in the great state of California, the last time I looked, which was like a month ago, every single person on the California State Parole Board is either an active corrections officer or formerly one of them. 100% of the parole board. And you're like, well, if the question is who should decide who's ready to be someone's neighbor, that should be a good cross-section of people. It certainly shouldn't be the corrections people, and it certainly shouldn't only be the police. But when you look at places like California with such a big, you know, they incarcerate the most people, blah, blah, blah. You look at this and you're like, that is A, by design, but B, crazy. You're like, of course nobody ever gets out on parole when these are the conditions. The other thing about parole that is interesting that I'll just plus on what you said about your article is that, you know, even when you get released, most people still have conditions put on them after they get released. So you could have like warrantless searches or parole officer check-ins or all these restrictions that are technically sort of after your release, like you sort of serve time and these just serve as like pathways to reincarceration. And there are some really progressive, like San Quentin is probably one of the most progressive prisons I've ever been to, like really, really ton of programming, film festival, da da da. And it still is prison. You're like, all these people don't need to be here. We got to redo this system, but the parole system has had some tweaks since the 70s. But it is untrue that everybody's eligible for parole. There are some states that have really good eligibility criteria, really fair processes. But again, you can have all the processes in the world, and when 100% of the people are some form of law enforcement, you're screwed on the front end.
Yeah.
This made me want to revisit W. Du Bois talking about the Talented 10th, because I think I could always reread something and learn a little bit more about it. But I tend to like a little bit disagree with you, Sharonda, when it comes to California, because I do think it is a neoliberal paradise. But I think one of the reasons why I like to use neoliberal now is because it gives just another hue of what we're living in as a society. And I do think that so much of Black people succeeding inside of culture is around assimilation. That's how come, from my memory, that's why I want to reread it. From my memory, W. Du Bois was saying, is the job of the Talented 10th to succeed, assimilate, and then go back and create networks in places for Black people who cannot do that, who are maybe so tethered to their West Africanness and into things that make them not not succeed in this kind of like African-European paradox that we find ourselves in order to free them. Toni Morrison herself said, if you find yourself free, your job is to free another. So I think to me, it makes sense. Like, it doesn't feel like anything has gone wrong. It feels like, oh, there's always been this kind of apparatus to punish, to disappear Black people, to disappear people who are unsuccessful at assimilating. And to me, the theme that I've been on this podcast is that to me, that counts as one of the failures of the Black intellectual, the Black organizer, the Black artist, like everybody's to me implicated in this, is the fact that, oh, wow, we are still kind of doing exactly the opposite of what Audre Lorde suggested. We're just like kind of trying to manipulate this machine and not creating like pathways out to be marooned from the machine. And I think that is probably the thing that needs to happen most if we're really going to see change, as well as, you know, fighting for whatever policy decisions that you think would relieve the pain and the pressure of the machine in the meantime.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
This podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Now, I've been a Squarespace fan since 2014 when we first started making them in the movement work, because I needed a platform that would allow me to have professional quality websites, and I didn't know how to code a single thing. And it's only gotten better over time. Now, Squarespace gives you everything you need to offer services and get paid all in one place. And if you need donations, all of it has all of the pieces to make the best website that you can ever make. From consultations to events and experiences, you can showcase your offerings with a customizable website designed to attract clients and grow your business. Get paid on time with professional on-brand invoices and online payments. Plus, streamline your workflow with built-in appointment scheduling and email marketing tools. And their collection of cutting-edge design tools means that you can make a bespoke online presence that perfectly fits your brand and your business. They now have Blueprint AI, Squarespace's AI-enhanced website builder, to get a fully custom website in just a few steps. Here's the thing. No matter where you start, your website is flexible to what you need. And there's drag and drop that just makes it easy. I've used it since 2014. Head to squarespace.com for a free trial. And when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/PSTP to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com/PSTP.
I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Just to show you that I'm right here in the neoliberal struggle with you, that I'd be looking at this 401k and I said, hold on. It can't be too radical. You got things to do. You got things to do. No, I can get on my own nerves a little bit. So I wanted to make my news a little fluffier, a little bit lighter. And I was looking for a gift for somebody. And I was trying to get them something embroidered. And it dawned on me. I'm like, wait, I wonder if there's like any Black businesses that embroider things. And I found that Black business that embroiders things. And it's called Bougie Brown Girl Company. And on Instagram, that's Bougie Brown Girl Co. And they had this post on it that was so interesting to me and connected to what we've been talking about. Because as I think about the end of respectability politics, which is something that I wrote about for the New York Times around Beyonce years ago, literally called Beyonce in the End of Respectability Politics, if you want to read it. Not my best, but, you know. I was in my 20s. But it did make me think, oh, if we're calling for the death of respectability politics, maybe we should have a birth of dignity politics. And what to me, a dignity politic can be that is informed by non-respectability politics is still understanding the power that we have through aesthetic and through cultural production to project something that is more positive than what the master narrative would be. So we remember Nakima and how they made it look like she was crying. We see all these kind of viral AI videos on TikTok showing Black people in the most degraded way that they can find, in the most stereotypical way they can find. So part of me was just like, oh my goodness, yes, nobody should have to behave like anything. Everybody should be able to express their sexuality, be able to experiment, be able to have a bad day or bad days or bad years or a bad life. But also, we shouldn't ignore how influential understanding like a dignity politic is in this company and along with this post called Being Bougie and Black Then Now and Always, which just talks about really deeply around Black people and our relationship with like both luxury and the bourgeois and how some of our choices when it comes to home decor and dining and style are, you know, yes, it could be seen as neoliberal nonsense, but I wouldn't just throw it in the trash like that. I will also say that being dignified, finding your own version of dignity, everybody's can look different. I think Doshi's looks different than mine. That looks different than everybody else's. So I'm not saying put clothes on. I'm just saying that when you actually absorb that politic and that kind of idea, that you can really create aesthetics and culture that transgresses. I'll read a little bit of the post. It says, history bite. During the Great Migration, 1916 to 1970, millions of Black families moved from the Jim Crow South to northern and western cities, searching for safety, opportunity, and dignity. With new jobs and access to education, Black women elevated how they dressed, how they spoke, how they kept their homes, and how they moved through the world. Others mocked this growth, called it bourgeois, but what they were really witnessing was Black aspiration in motion. So again, because I wrestle with a lot of things that I agree with and don't agree with at one time, I don't agree with all those different things that I just listed because some of them feel anti-South. They feel anti-heritage. But I also think that we can look at maybe what those Black women were trying to achieve, and now we have more scholarship. Now we've been through more. Now we're in a different place. So we can still chew our own meat and spit out our own bones. And I think that I found it really productive and really interesting. Last thing I'll say just to close it out is there's this artist called Spallada, and he just came out with a video called The Cuntiest and a song called The Cuntiest. And he looks so elegant and so beautiful. And I love, love, love that image creation. And it made me think about my bathroom that I renovated. And when I started to decorate it, one of the things that I wanted was this picture that I love of Sam Cooke. And he's in a suit and he's embracing and he's smiling. And it's so important to me that before I walk out of my bathroom, before I walk out into the world, that I see an image and an affirmation of Black dignity and Black elegance, because that's important for me to activate. And I think the more you see what the right produces, you'll understand that, yeah, it can feel shallow and like a nothing, but obviously it's not, or they wouldn't be manipulating it so much. So I wanted to ask you all, what are you all doing that is finding you dignity, either in a home decor choice or dining choice or a style choice? How are y'all finding your excellence and your dignity?
This actually made me think of two things before I answer your question, Miles. One was the conversation we had around that Rolling Stone piece about Jasmine Crockett and her being her own phone wallpaper and why we think she might be making that kind of choice, given even our conversation just a few minutes ago about, you know, how she is portrayed in the public. And I was like, oh, I could see her saying like, this is when I feel my best, when I look my best. And I want to also look at myself and this version of myself because I need to steel myself against what's going to come my way today. So that was actually one of my first thoughts. My second thought was actually about my grandmother, who, I don't know, I must have been like 10 or 11, redid the living room and her bedroom in French provincial style furniture. And I hated it. You know, I was like, this shit is ugly, you know? But I think for her, that had been such an aspirational aesthetic that, you know, even as a grandmother raising three kids, right, three of her grandchildren, she was like, this is it. Like, I want this. I'm going to do it. I can afford to do it. I've saved for it. And what that meant for, like, even how we enjoyed the living room or didn't after that, you know? But then with respect to sort of what some of the choices that I've made, interestingly enough, I've made choices to have bold colors in my home. And I don't wear bold colors in my wardrobe. But if you come to my home, like my couches are blue and orange, and I have peacocks on my wallpaper, and I have deep blues on my wall, and I have deep blue velvet bar stools. You know what I mean? And for me, it's because I want my home to be a place where, like, if you kick up your feet, you feel embraced, you feel held, and you like the way that the furry pillow on the couch feels, you know? And so that's been an evolution for me, honestly, probably in the last like 4 or 5 years. So much so that I got my couch dyed because I had a vision for a very specific color orange that I wanted. So yeah, that's how I've thought about that in my home decor choice.
I'm pretty easy. I'm like a hoarder from being raised by my great-grandmother. So I have a lot of everything. I have like enough toilet paper to last a lifetime, enough deodorant to last a lifetime. I have a ton of books on the thing. And I love the way my apartment looks, but my friends who are interior designers, they did my apartment for me.
That's what I was hoping you would talk about.
All I did was I approved it and they were great and they did it for free. Like I mean, I had to buy the furniture, but they did the design. So it's one of the reasons why I haven't moved, because it's just such a cute apartment and I don't know if they'll do the next apartment for free. So love the way it looks. I wouldn't have, but in hindsight, I probably would have gotten a cloth couch because my, I don't know, suede or leather, whatever it is, not as fun to sleep on, but.
It is not. You wake up sweaty.
Yeah, it's like a little interesting, but I would have gotten a cloth couch if I had thought about it differently, but they did everything. They chose the paint colors, everything. Shout out to them.
I love it. I was hoping that you would talk about that. Like, I think that it's so cool. And because you do such work, which has you in these different environments, I think that like having like a home base that feels dignified and like it's a, you know, we know that you probably wouldn't have done it yourself. So I love that you come home to something that is like elegant and affirming to yourself, because you'll be in the world and you don't know what you're going to see.
Mm-hmm. You really won't. Shout out to them. They did it. My news is about ice. So, you know, I talked about the ice polling at the beginning of the pod, but the Dems released some sort of demands and they were just really weak. I was very disappointed. Our team has been working on ice demands for a while and their demands came out in the middle of the night. And I can say a lot about them, but they're two buckets. One is like, what does it mean to have a demand for accountability from an administration that's already said they're not going to do it? So almost half of the demands that the Dems put out are things that would need to be enforced by somebody, and the somebody would be the DOJ or the U.S. attorneys, and they've already said they're not going to do it. So you could ban masks being worn by ICE agents, but somebody has to enforce the ban, and they're not going to do it. So you're like, okay, well, that doesn't work. So there are a host of things like that. And then there's a second bucket of things in the DEM demands that are already the law, or like already in place. So one of them is uphold use of force standards. Campaign Zero, I worked with the Biden White House to write the updated use of force standards for the federal government. We did it in 2022. They are good. They're not following them. What are you going to do? Like if they, you know, we can write them better, but they already said they're not going to follow them. And if they don't follow them, there's no consequence. Unlike with local police departments, it's a little different because we have a whole range of things that we can do for accountability. Federal government, you only got two things. It's either the DOJ or like it's either a federal agency or it's the U.S. attorneys. And Trump has absolute authority over them right now. And it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So we rolled out a set of demands that you can find at 10toendice.org. So 10toendice.org. And I won't go through all 10, but all 10 I think are great, but two I'm going to talk about. The first is, instead of having to fight about the budget, when we poll around the country, we realize that the public doesn't have a good understanding of like $75 billion to $100 billion, da, da, da. And ICE got so much money that you could actually cut a big chunk of money and it won't matter. So if you go from $150 billion to $125 billion, not really, I mean, it is good, but not really a win for us because that's still a ton of money for them to wreak havoc. So we took a different approach and we were like, we're going to make a cap of staff. So we're going to say if only 5% of the arrests that happen by ICE are for people convicted of felonies, we will staff you at 5%. We'll give you enough staff to deal with that subset of people, because that seems to be what people are freaked out about. If we do that, then the staffing will go from 22,000 to 1,100, We're like, cool, we'll give you 1,100 officers. And we will fund you for 1,100 officers, which will take the ICE budget to around $300 million from, you know, I don't know, $10 billion a year. And we're like, you know, feels like a much easier way to like fight this budget fight and a little more sane. And the second one that we have a stake in the ground around is around the scope for Border Patrol. Border Patrol right now has the power to patrol within 100 miles of the American border. 2 out of 3 people in the country live within 100 miles of the American border. 12 U.S. states are completely covered by the 100-mile rule with border control, which is crazy. It's like not a border anymore if it's 100 miles away from the border. So our proposal, and other people have proposed this before, it just hasn't taken off, is that the border would be reduced to 10 miles. That Border Patrol can patrol within 10 miles of the American border, which is still pretty far. That would be like from the port in New York City to the Brooklyn Bridge, which does not feel like the border. But 10 miles is much better than 100 miles. And then we are demanding that Border Patrol no longer have the power to conduct warrantless searches, which they can conduct in the radius. So within 100 miles of the American border today, they can conduct warrantless searches. They can put up those like checkpoints where they stop people and stuff like that. So you should go check out the demands. I wanted to talk about them here. And I think one of the things I'm struck by, because I now feel like I've lived through 3 of these national moments. It was Ferguson, it was George Floyd, now it is Minneapolis. And I think I thought people would have a better sense of policy demands by now, just because we've done it a couple times. And I was in a conversation with people talking about what to do, and they had hyper-local issues, which makes them, they are the right thing. So they're like, Minneapolis, Minnesota should have a eviction ban. Because that makes sense, because people aren't going to work and, you know, stores are closed. And they were talking about how important it is to fund mutual aid groups and all that stuff. Also, we got to do it. Like, it has to, you have to do that stuff. But they were talking about these things as leading to the end of ICE. And you're like, those are good things to do. And they are not structural in the sense that like, they will stop ICE from doing anything. Like, they just aren't those things. So I take all these things as a challenge. Like, how do we get people to understand the big demands? Because like, the public is actually, when we poll, is like very with us. Our elected leaders are not. We got to push them. But they'll only get pushed if people demand big things. And, you know, I'd hoped that the third go round, people would be better. The last thing I'll say too is that I'm shocked at people who are shocked at the police this time. They're like, wow, the police have never acted like this. I was in a conversation like that the other day, and I was like, well, I don't know if that's true. Or they're like, the police are just arresting people. And you're like, yes. You know, so I'm not even resentful about it. I'm just surprised, actually, I think, if anything else.
Yeah, I mean, I was glad to see this come out. I think it's important that someone who can force a conversation, put some stakes in the ground around what they think is important and what will get us to a place of abolition. And so, you know, when I shared it, I also shared an open invitation for people to let me know what they think, right? Because I think it's important to engage in conversation around these kinds of issues. I also pulled out my little like Miriam Kaba checklist for like police reforms you should always oppose versus like support. And I was like, okay, where does this fall? You know, because I'm like, let me see based on an organizer framework that I have come to respect and adopt and adapt for my own work and life. And then I thought a lot about, you know, DeRay, to your point of this kind of being the third kind of national moment where you've led work that has been highly visible around some of the public narrative, conversation, discourse, and pushback around 8 Can't Wait, right? And around the critique of that being an incrementalist approach, right? And a reformist approach when there seemed to be a public appetite for abolition. And I think we've been talking about for the last few weeks, and even earlier in this conversation, about there seeming to be a ton of public support for abolition, but us not really knowing what people mean by abolition, right? So I'm wondering how you are thinking about where this 10 to end ICE falls along that like reform to abolition spectrum, if you see it as both more radical and potentially more effective than previous campaigns like 8 Can't Wait, and what you want people to really contend with as this sort of takes on, because once you release it, it takes on a public life of its own, right?
Yeah, I think what we just got in front of the narrative on this better than we did. 8 Can't Wait, we sort of put the 8 out, and we hadn't written a paragraph about anything. Our intent, it just was sort of out, and that ran away from us. I do think these are just different than local police departments. People sort of hate the police sometimes, but they like their police department. It's sort of a weird thing we find in the in the data. Whereas this is an agency. This is like a random agency. I think people think about it very differently. Immigration laws will still be enforced, whether or not ICE exists tomorrow or not. And the reality is that ICE is catching people in air quotes, after they are getting out of local prisons and jails. So like, you know, ICE isn't stopping crime. So there's that. So I do think that that matters. But, you know, you are right, is that when we look at the data, you know, if you ask people for a set of reforms they support, they move away from abolition, right? If you say, do you support abolition? They say yes. Then you give them some other things like body cameras. They're like, well, I actually support that. And you're like, well, this is sort of yikes, right? The thing that I think is different, and we've tried to be transparent about this, is that we think that the North Star is to zero out the ICE budget and keep it moving. ICE is just got here. So we've lived in a world before ICE, we'll live in a world without ICE. And then we say, we understand that we don't have all of the political power to just make that happen overnight. So in that case, here are things that we can do. And if you do the 10 things that we have done, you just dramatically constrain ICE's ability to do anything. Going from 22,000 officers to 1,100 fundamentally changes ICE's ability to do much. So we've tried to use procedural things to sort of ham it up that don't require the DOJ or somebody to do right by people, because we assume bad faith actors in the process here, which is not a strategy we took before. So like, we're also saying that any property bought by ICE since January 20th, 2025 has to be immediately sold, given to cities, and they can't buy any more property and they can't buy planes. Like, you know, we can stop deportations if there's just no planes, right? Like, it's just, you know, planes no more, right? So we've tried to go that route to sort of squelch ICE if we can't get a zero budget.
What you speaking did make me think about, though, was economics. It made me think about local economics and people focusing on mutual aid and economics, because food and housing and all these different things are such a big deal to people. And I think even for myself, like, I've had so many different class experiences, really high class experiences and low ones. And what I know is I can't think about anything that is national if I don't do those things. So I think that even when things get more quiet, if we ever see, like, say, like in like 8 years, we see another Democratic leader or something like that. Like, I think that, oh, I ain't joking. But like, but like.
No, I'm laughing because 8 years is an improvement from never, which is usually where you are. That's what I'm laughing at. Yeah.
Optimism. But I think that like, that needs to be so imperative, because that is foundational to people being able to be activated around these things, specifically people who might actually absorb some more radical ideas in politics. I even think about so many people not being for the abolition of police, but not for it when it actually hits their town. I would inject that it's not just because of safety. I would inject because they know people in their town who have jobs in the police, and they don't want to hurt their husband, their brothers, whoever got the jobs that are with the police. So much of support of police is because of economic devastation. The last thing that I'll say too, that you made me think of, is, and I'm not a policymaker, I'll be so upset if I hear this though, like, sometimes I'm like, wait, is somebody gonna take this, or who's all listening? But what I will say is, I think because of the fear of what's going on, because of the inadequacy of Democrats, I think once Trump is out of office, or once Democrats are in control, I think that something branded like an anti-dictator bill would be really powerful. And I think a lot of things being folded into that, because I think we kind of chase these little instances, but I think so many people know about martial law and shit like that now, that something that's an anti-dictator bill would be really, really, really powerful. And if I see that bill come and I don't get no type of check,
not a check for a piece of legislation. You're hilarious.
Yes. I want to be like the Republicans. Just no islands.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Milesy Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.